Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, and we're live here a few hours earlier, so extra credit to our regulars who like to join us live that paid attention to the time. So I see Paul, of course, he always reads the syllabus. So Paul is there in the chat room. And for those that are with us live today, I'd like to invite you to go ahead and go over to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. And if there are some points of order you'd like to make during the course of the show or a question you would like for us to address to our guest, that's the perfect place to do it. And if you have a busy day and you've got to take off and you want to see what you've missed, remember, if you don't already, you can go ahead over to iTunes or Spreaker or whatever podcast aggregator you get, and you can go ahead and subscribe to the podcast. It doesn't cost a thing, and that way Midrats will be ready for you whenever you are ready in your busy schedule. And hey, let's go ahead and dive on into today's show. It's we talked a little bit at the pre-show. I thought we had our today's guest on, at the end of the summer, but it's actually been almost a year, and it's amazing what can happen in a year. Last April, when we had our guest on, one thing we talked about was, for those that remember ancient history, it seems like it, that's when Ever Given had decided to impale itself on the side of the Suez, and that international maritime trade system we have was already under various stresses, and we'll talk about them again today, due to COVID. And when you take out a major choke point like that, these unexpected events can have tremendous ripple effects throughout everybody's supply chain. And anybody that goes to the grocery store or fills up a tank of gas is all up to speed with that. And of course, we all know what has happened in the last year. Other external events have come in and have open some eyes to some long understood fundamentals that were conveniently, if not forgotten, overlooked, and also gives us some visions on where things may go in the future. So if you are worried about the cost and availability of your fuel, food, and everyday items, and you spent the last decade assuming they were always going to be there at a price you're happy with, then today's the right place. Returning guests, Ross Kennedy is with us for the full hour. Ross is a U.S.-based logistics and supply chain expert with more than 15 years in international transportation, procurement, and analysis. Ross, welcome back to Midrats.
Gentlemen, thank you. We were talking in the pre-show, and we were, sort of right in the middle of the Ever Given incident the last time I was here. And, of course, I'm not entirely sure this is our fault, but we are now dealing with the Ever Forward that has currently beached itself in the Chesapeake Bay. And, for a couple of weeks now, operations have been underway to try to refloat that vessel, and it's not gone well to this point. So if April is going to be our annual get-together and look at, overview of the world supply chains, we can hope that maybe the third time is the charm for Evergreen.
Exactly. They do come in threes, it seems. So at least it was the Chesapeake where you have lots of room to maneuver in most of the bay. But last year, that was that external impact on the market. And of course, the pre-existing conditions with COVID, and most people have noted that this week, Shanghai is not a small town, both for China and for the international community because of the trade and the port and the manufacturing and everything else. China has locked down millions and millions of people in Shanghai, and those are the people that work in the docks and the shipyards and the factories and the financial systems due to COVID, because the Chinese Communist Party, like all communist parties, once the party says something, regardless of what may happen, they will stick with it. So they're still going for that COVID zero. But to add to those supply shocks, and one thing that you and I have talked about, and I know Eagle One has as well with yourself and other people, is the external shocks to the international trade system that's been brought about since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So I just thought I'd kind of kick things off as a guy who lives and breathes this stuff. You remember that glorious magical land of yesteryear where the logistics and the maritime trade like to brag about this wonderfully exquisite, well-timed, just-in-time delivery system that when it worked, it saved microcents per ton, which when you do millions of tons, that turns into real money, works until it doesn't. You know, talk for a little bit about what you see as some of the quick look lessons learned about external shocks to our trade system.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It's the Black Sea, you know, what we could call the Black Sea issue, although, you know, call it the war of Russian, czarist aggression, call it a neighborhood spat, whatever it may be, but there is a real cost in lives and materiel and certainly in disruption to the world that has come about since Russia invaded Ukraine at the end of February. And the Black Sea region is for, I think, a lot of Americans, at least, certainly not navalists, who are obviously extremely familiar with the region, you know, with the region. But the average American really probably up until 2 months ago couldn't have pointed to the Black Sea on a map, couldn't have identified, you know, Ukraine and Russia and their relative position to one another, let alone Europe. Certainly not. Ukraine and that part of Russia is really critical importance to the world from an energy side as well as from a grain side. And, you know, we talk about these exogenous or external shocks to the system, and food is really one of those that a lot of people don't understand where it comes from or how it gets made or how really industrialized food production is, no less so than, you know, the production of the tractors themselves or the production and transport of energy products or, you know, industrial chemicals, whatever it may be. There's not a whole lot of farm to fork in the world. There are a relative few breadbaskets in the world where a significant percentage of global cereals, which is corn, you know, wheat, millet, sorghum, a lot of these rice, where these can be grown, at least grown at some form of really significant global impact scale. The United States is one of them. Brazil is another. And the Black Sea region certainly is every bit as fertile as some of the most fertile and productive ground here in the U.S. And other very large parts of the world rely on these relatively few breadbaskets to produce not only enough grain to feed their regions that they're based in, but to really export at a significant surplus. And that has diplomatic and geopolitical considerations tied to it, geoeconomic considerations. And so as Ukraine and that southwestern part of Russia go on the Black Sea region, you're talking about a significant ability to move global markets. And there was a thread that was on Twitter here a week or two ago, and it was, you know, oh, it's not so bad. It's only 25% of exports, but that doesn't include everything grown in these countries. India has stepped up. They'll be able to replace that, you know, that missing percentage of exports from the Black Sea region for this year, you know, with excess production in India and in the United States. And quite simply, that's not the case. Because of the way wheat is grown in that part of the world, as well as generally here in the U.S., by and large, we cultivate winter wheat. In Ukraine, we cultivate it here in the U.S. And so that crop was in the ground in September and October of last year, really before any of this started. The crop is now maturing as we come into spring, and you know, harvest will commence on that. And, you know, the May-June sort of time frame. And what we've seen is really a significant portion of the agrarian production zone in Ukraine, certainly the logistics arteries, the rail and the roads to get it to the Black Sea for export, and the export ports on the Black Sea, you know, Mariupol and Odessa being two very important ones, all of that is now completely disrupted. And we don't know what percentage of the crop is going to be left standing, let alone how many individuals are going to be able to get in and harvest this crop. And that goes for Russia as well, for its part of the wheat production there. We don't know if corn or soybeans or anything else are going to be able to be planted following it. We can assume, though, that at least half the output of the region is probably going to disappear, and not from the export market, but also for domestic use in Ukraine, use in Europe, people that rely on direct exports from Ukraine and Russia. So everybody is sitting here going, well, gosh, we're 100% or some significant amount of dependency on wheat from that, but that's going to take a year to 2 years to replenish itself after the hostilities are said and done, and things can begin to resume, you know, as normal. So we're looking at a really significant disruption on some of these cereal crops. But then when you stack on top of that, that, you know, that being one shock to the system is tough but doable. But major wheat production regions in the U.S. have been experiencing significant drought since planting, not near enough subsoil moisture, not enough snow, not enough rain over the winter months and here into spring to really make a good crop. So we could be looking at a pretty significant yield loss in the U.S., despite the fact we planted some more acres of wheat last fall. And Brazil as well, although it's not a big wheat production region, Brazil is a significant producer of corn and soybeans. Their winter crop, which is their version of, you know, our spring crop, which is when a lot of their corn is grown, did not do well. Suffered some pretty significant yield losses due to drought and a few other things. And now there's safrinha, their second corn crop that they plant in Brazil that they really rely on to make their export markets work. That's looking like it's off to a pretty rough start from a planting and early season, you know, vigor standpoint. So where we could potentially replace wheat production, like with India, we haven't done enough. Where we typically rely on very bountiful harvests that can get into the global markets and provide some stability to food prices, not only in export-dependent countries, but also, you know, just countries that typically grow enough to consume for themselves. We're seeing significant, you know, loss of production off the market. And then your replacement crops, where you could potentially replace wheat in the diet with something else. Usually in most parts of the world, that's rice. We can anticipate some pretty significant turmoil and inability to really get, you know, maximize yields on those as well. But in China, India, the U.S., Brazil. So a lot of challenges here have just kind of stacked up. And now we're talking about a situation where that first domino has tipped over, which is the Black Sea region, and the world does not have the time to catch up this year. And so we're in for at least one, if not 2 years, assuming everything is perfect moving forward, 1 to 2 years of fairly significant shortage and disruption to what global, you know, food systems have become accustomed to. From a supply and demand standpoint. So it's a really long way of saying it's not just about the exports. It's about when you're talking about a vastly complex, wholly integrated system, such as the global food supply chain, where a few countries produce the vast majority of surplus for the world, the effects are compounding, or they're, you know, logarithmic, they're not linear. And it very much from a global geopolitical stability standpoint bears watching.
Yeah, I started looking at, I mean, China's been sucking up a lot over the last few months before all this happened, sucking up a lot of the grain available in the markets. And they've apparently stockpiled, and we don't know under what conditions, but it's stockpiled a substantial quantity of stuff. Is there intrusion into these markets another factor in what could be a potential disaster in making for the rest of the world?
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up the China thing. It's you know, starting in 2017 and into 2018, And even in 2019, China, which like the U.S. has a highly industrialized food system, really started dealing with a major issue, which was probably the biggest issue they faced on the food security side for quite a long time, which is a nationwide outbreak of African swine fever. It's extremely difficult to eradicate. It's more virulent and deadly to the animals even than highly pathogenic avian influenza is, bird flu, which we're dealing with here in the U.S. right now. But they lost anywhere from 50 to 60% of their swine population. And that's not just fully grown hogs that were ready to be processed for retail distribution to the consumer side. That was piglets. That was sows. That was, all the animals up and down that breeding chain and production chain. And it really set them back. And so their consumption of domestic feed ingredients fell. They began exporting a lot more. Because they were overproducing supply in their market. And now what we've seen at some point is they've started to get their legs back under them and get African swine fever under control. But now they have begun, they've flipped it around again and become highly consumptive, first from a stockpiling standpoint of things like soybeans, corn, and wheat, rice, other animal proteins that can be frozen for some length of time. But now they have rebuilt their strategic stockpiles and continue to consume and stockpile. And so at some point in the early to middle part of last year, that just vacuum-like appetite that China has had for, global foodstuffs that they've been just buying hand over fist, at some point that switched from replenishment of their own stockpiles that they had eaten through and, due to several bad production years. It turned into now what are they doing? Well, they're hoarding. They're hoarding because I suspect they had long known in advance, or at least had some idea that what we're seeing in Ukraine was coming. Russia, that part of Russia, the Black Sea region, Ukraine and Russia both are very significant exporters to China. I believe China is the number one destination market for wheat and corn from Ukraine. So it's very telling that China had begun, continued long past what they needed, quote unquote, from a stockpiling standpoint to tipped over into hoarding, and doing so pretty heavily from a region that we're now seeing is incredibly disrupted by war and by conflict and will be for some time. And China is now sitting on this very large the statistics vary, but it could be as much as 30 to 40% of available cereals on the market in the last year. China has bought up and exported or imported to itself, and it's sitting on them and their stockpiles all over China. And that's enormous. You're talking about a real powerful geopolitical lever there, where if China was looking ahead into 2022, they maybe knew that significant shortages or disruption was coming. What a powerful lever it would be to be able to go to countries and say, hey, for those of you that don't produce enough for yourselves, we've got what you need. But just like Belt and Road and Wolf Warrior diplomacy, this is sort of an extension of manipulating global markets and supply of valuable commodities to achieve, China's, sort of hegemonic aims. So it's really that's another one of those sort of external factors that 2-3 years ago, we maybe weren't looking at, but now we must consider that there is really an integrated, longer-term plan or program in place here between some of these nations to work very cooperatively on mutual aims, but also work very supportively on the individual, domestic or regional aims of each of those countries, and that would be Iran, that'd be Russia, that'd be Pakistan, China, and even to some extent India.
That's one of the things that I was wondering what they're going to do with that supply of already pre-existing grain. And, you mentioned about people saying, well, maybe, India can just increase their production. There is no such thing as a food button that you can press and all of a sudden things magically appear. Part of the green revolution that, we grew up reading about had to do with not just new variants of crops that are more productive and can work in different types of soils and environmental conditions, but also it was the ready availability of inexpensive fertilizers that could make marginal land highly productive. And, you know, one of the stats I looked at this weekend, it was interesting. It was an article about, well, something that I've seen in my neighbors and their acreage, what they've been converting over. They usually would grow, alternate between cotton and peanuts, but they're, because this land has been under cultivation since the Revolutionary War, it's a little spent. Cotton can do that to land, but it's fertilizer. And in the USA alone, that the Russia gave us 15% of our imports of certain types of fertilizers. And farmers have seen some types of fertilizer in different lands require different fertilizers or mixes. But, you know, when you look at your nitrogen, whether it's ammonium nitrate or urea, some variants of that are up 127%. Which is costing an extra, you know, $1,500+ per acre. And when you're a farmer that's doing, you know, especially out in the Midwest, that they don't own hundreds of acres, they own thousands of acres. That's significant. And so while, you know, a lot of people think about wheat, also Russia and that part of Ukraine also produce a lot of corn. And American farmers are just looking at the fact that they can't afford to take out the loans with the risk of the weather. And so a lot of our corn land is converted over to soybeans. And it's, you know, China is the world's number one importer of soybeans. And, you know, when you look at the inflation that's going into our food system, whether you eat bread or you eat corn finished beef or poultry or anything else that is fed with these grains, I keep thinking back to 2011 when there was, I believe it was weather-caused increase of wheat prices. That was the match that was lit on under the what became the Arab Spring. So when you look at how all these different inflationary costs are rolling into the international trade, on top of already existing raw material inflation throughout, what are some of the things that the listeners should look at where these inflationary food price increases could potentially move over into disruption or in poor places like sub-Saharan Africa, additional coercion from the Chinese embassy that says, I hear you need, you know, 20,000 metric tons of rye. I know where we can find that.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a great point that it's not just the it's not just the first order of finished grains or cereals or oilseeds, right? It's the whole downstream ecosystem of it, that second and third order gap that now exists as well. You look at Russia and Belarus are the leading producers in the world of potash, and have locked down exports on those, which, you know, fertilizer for the last 2 years, I wouldn't say has been hand to mouth, but it is certainly, it's not what it was price-wise in terms of availability and you know, lower cost when we began really utilizing, you know, NPK, synthetic NPK very heavily for nutrients. So that's a significant disruption. We've seen real serious disruption to the phosphorus market with countervailing duties that were put on Russian and Moroccan exporters. China has locked down on its exports of various phosphate products as well as nitrogen products, particularly urea. And, you know, much like you said, there's really no food button. There isn't for fertilizer either. This stuff has to be mined. It has to be refined and in a lot of cases, you know, blended, you know, chemically together to make compound fertilizers. So it's not just you buy a whole bunch of straight potash and put it out, you know, and spread it in the field at the proper amount of nutrients. It's that potash is actually going to be blended with a couple of other things and turned into, you know, a more well-rounded nutrient profile for the corn. But sometimes that's not being done there. It's, you know, the raw materials are being mined in two or three places and then sent to a third place to be pulled together into a finished product, and then it's got to be delivered. And And all of that delivery is happening on dry bulk vessels, or for the liquid products, it's happening on tankers, or it's happening in, you know, 275-gallon IBC totes, or it's happening in ISO tanks. You know, all of this stuff has to be made somewhere and moved somewhere else. And in the case of China and Russia, what you've seen with their outright export block, you know, blockades, if you will, on a lot of these food and, or a lot of these fertilizer ingredients, those aren't going to be just right back on the market in the next 2 weeks when they decide, hey, war's over, everybody go home, and business can resume as usual. It is going to continue to be a challenge and an issue. In the U.S., we are very fortunate to be able to produce a lot of our own fertilizers that we need, although we are not 100% self-sufficient. We're in better conditions than most. Europe is in much more difficult shape than we are. Africa as well. So there's a lot of places in the world that are highly productive or at least self-sufficient in terms of foodstuff production, but they've still got to have the chemicals, the seed, the fertilizer, et cetera. The fourth order thing that we face here in the U.S. is not going to be this year, but it's going to be what decisions are farmers going to be making next year and the forward years around the fact that we've got sort of this double whammy of input, you know, this disruption, higher prices. Corn in particular is a very nutrient hungry product, and we have a massive industrialized supply chain that is built up around corn as a primary feedstock. I saw a statistic the other day that Cargill, it's the starches, sweeteners, and texturizers division, which is their term for wet corn milling. That division produces 23 different products from corn, not just, you know, what we think of, which is corn oil or high fructose corn syrup or ethanol and its co-products. It's things like, you know, vitamins that are extracted from corn, amino acids for animal feed, you know, food ingredients that go into, you know, things like corn pops and all of that, right? So as that becomes more disrupted, at the same time, we've got situations, you know, land values in the U.S. are phenomenally high. Not just on the residential side, where very famously you've got enormous bull run and the U.S. housing market, you know, investors like BlackRock coming in and buying up a lot of stuff, but it's also highly productive farmland. You know, some farm ground in Illinois in the last 2 weeks, it was over 600 acres sold for an average price of $17,500 an acre. This was not for commercial development. It was not adjacent to commercial land that was zoned for that. This is just regular farmland. And so very quickly, the U.S. Farm system is bifurcating into the haves and have-nots, those who have optionality, those who have a significant asset base and can, you know, maybe pay up for higher inputs or borrow more money to put a crop out and weather that storm. And then you have people that are, you know, hand-to-mouth and on a, you know, year-to-year basis trying to decide what the least amount of cashy crop I can put out that may, you know, yield well and let me continue farming for another year. And you're going to see that worldwide as well. So the long-term effects of all of this, the long-term effects of decisions that China is making right now to hoard grain, drive prices higher, switch to, you know, and now farmers in the U.S. are saying, well, it's really expensive. I put all my fertility on in the spring instead of the fall. I can't get a little fertilizer. I guess I'm going to grow soybeans this year on ground that's not already locked into corn. And that we can see that those decisions that are made a world away for reasons that are unfathomable to any of us really do have an impact on the bottom line here at home for a lot of people that we rely on and are pretty hand to mouth in terms of their corporate existence. So it's When I encourage people to really take a look at what's going on in the world and to understand at least some level how these complex systems work, and they don't, or they look at a chart and they say, well, 10 years ago the chart said this, and so we can assume this will be that way again. It's we're nowhere near, you know, what we were 5 years ago or 10 years ago. We're in a lot of ways in a very brave new world. Even the Navy's ability to sort of be the, you know, the guarantor of the global commons, the safety of the global commons. We're in a very different paradigm now worldwide, and with naval readiness and with the U.S.'s ability to, you know, achieve good sea lift in the event of a conflict. That's a consideration. It has to be a consideration in U.S. food policy or trade policy compared to where we were 20 or even 30 years ago.
Well, one of the complicating factors, as I see it, is we tend to shoot ourselves in the foot. About 30%, I think, of corn production goes to ethanol, which means that that grain is not available for use as food or feed for animals. And as you say, corn is not an easy product. Despite the fact you can grow it almost anywhere, it seems like the massive fields of corn are not an easy thing to grow without a lot of attention and chemical byproducts. One of the other things I looked at the other day, I was watching this is a wrinkle on my part, but I was watching RFD, which is the rural network that's available on cable and other places, and they had a pretty good show put on by one of the organizations that looks at cattle ranching. And one of the issues that currently is pending is the Biden administration did away with the rules that were created under the Trump administration, which had generous exemptions for certain agricultural waters, like your stock pond or occasional streams and stuff. And so now they're back to square one. And the question is that they were trying to answer is, what are the waters of the United States? And is every cattle rancher, everybody who has some kind of crop someplace, who's got these agriculture and irrigational units, going to have to go to the feds to get the permits to operate what they're currently doing without having to do that, which was also going to greatly increase the cost of food, because that's an expensive process to go through that. Are there other situations like that in this complex food chain that most people would be unaware of, that they need to know about, and why things are, in addition to the shortages created by artificial shortages created by China, why food is going higher and higher?
Yeah, absolutely. The question about riparian rights is really, really an important one, and I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, it's water in so many ways is really the new oil in terms of the next great global consideration for, potential to reshape geopolitical alliances and start wars. Here in the U.S., we've got a significant depletion of water resources, especially out west. We've had two straight years of drought in large parts of the U.S. The Colorado River has, of course, that's been sort of a regional issue. It's not been on a lot of people's radars, but is enormously impactful to the production of a lot of produce in the U.S. For example, it comes out of a part of California that relies on the Colorado River to help feed its watershed. You're talking about Lake Mead there, which is the reservoir behind Hoover Dam, is at critically low levels and still falling. So we're dealing with it here in the U.S., the overall reservoir, which enormous amounts of irrigation in the U.S. and the West pulls from the overall underground reservoir, the aquifer. You're talking there that restrictions have been ongoing for years and are continuing to be more and more and more restrictive as far as what farmers can actually pull. I know in North Texas, a farmer who is drawing half the water now per acre than he was 10 years ago. Half. And he's seen the impact in his yields and his crop production to that. And so a lot of the ways that we've become dependent on water to supplement our ability to manufacture food has become a real challenge, too. And that's not just here, it's worldwide. Some of the other things that I think we're going to continue to see be issues, certainly the parts and labor to do mechanized agriculture. We saw a strike at John Deere, and if that had been delayed any longer would have been a real challenge. But I think pretty much every farmer in the U.S. can tell you stories about how critical parts that they've needed for their combines or their tractors or their planters or their grain, the conveyor belt on their grain bin, they couldn't get a bearing because, bearing went out, so they couldn't use their grain bins. We're really seeing that. We're now into the second and even third year of issues on parts shortages for critical things. Semiconductors certainly is not going to go away as a problem. Here in the U.S., where I think our biggest risk is on the political side. Every generation that goes by, we become more divorced at the political and policy level from the trades, from the blue collars. There was a time when, a lot of the people in Congress had grown up on a farm, or grown up adjacent to a shipyard, and maybe even worked there themselves before, going to college and becoming a member of Congress. And now what we have is largely a political class that is very lawyer-heavy. A lot of the ones that aren't lawyers come from a financial background. And so what happens on K Street, what happens on Wall Street, is more important from what farmers and tradesmen, guys that work on the oil rigs, from what they're seeing at ground level. They're saying, hey, the system's breaking. It's been breaking for a decade or two decades, and that margin of error, that surplus, we've eaten away at that, and we no longer have that. Now we're hand-to-mouth as an industry as well. And I don't see, I see glimmers of hope, but at scale, I certainly don't see a really cohesive, united understanding for the Democrat and Republican parties and any sort of ability to connect good policy to Main Street, to things that generate jobs, but also result in the manufacturing of real, actual, physical things that our nation relies on for its economic stability and national security. The bad policy around water, the bad policy around environmental and air quality and things like that are really an output or, a second order effect of a complete and total failure national level of politicians to listen to the right people, and political interests and financial interests, and invest long term into ourselves as a nation, the same way we saw a huge benefit to society from things like the interstate highway system that Eisenhower built, and we continue to enjoy the dividends of that today, some 70 years later from the beginning of that project. I don't see us really doing that, and we need to. That is probably the biggest threat we face today.
We kind of touched on it. I wanted to circle back to it. The brave new world we're in. I'm convinced there are certain inflection points in history. In the post-Cold War period in the 1990s, that was a clear change for everybody, economic, political, technology. That's when you have the dot-com boom, everything else. And you can kind of see it when it's taking place if you're, taking a holistic view of everything. And I just have a nagging feeling we're at another one of those inflection points when you have the Russian invasion of Ukraine, though there were warnings with Georgia and Crimea before, it has stripped away all but the most hardcore at realizing the fact that what people wanted Russia to be is not what Russia is or became, and that's going to have to be a new reality. Same thing in the post-Cold War era, that was, China's peaceful rise and the micro cents per ton that you can make in profit from offshoring to China with all those incentives and things you don't have to worry about, like environmental controls. That's the way to go. That's the future. But when you look at the political fallout and the economic changes that are most likely going to take place towards Russia, and people's growing understanding of what China believes the future looks like, vice what people wanted China to think the future looked like, that we're going to see changes, whether it's economic or whether it's just the good business decision to either rehome manufacturing or to move to Central America or other places in Asia that minimizes that risk. And it's been kind of nice to see in fits and starts that North America, i.e. U.S. and Canada, and our European NATO partners are starting to be more aligned, plus or minus a country or two, than they were 9 months ago, kind of shifting that geoeconomic order with trade in a different direction than where it was pre-COVID, especially pre-invasion of Ukraine. What are some of those trends that you see starting to form in the mist that may portend a 2028 that would be remarkably different in this area than what it was in 2019?
That's a good question. The largest trend, which, I've not been silent about, certainly by any means, is the great decoupling or, bifurcation, right? And really what that's going to look like is BRICS, against, I would say, if not the Anglosphere, certainly a more Western-led order that is, if not fully decoupled, certainly arm's length from a lot of the BRICS countries. China and Russia are clearly leading the way on that. Brazil, India are going to continue, I think, to have a foot in both worlds. And the rest of the world that's really not the key players at the top of, or at the center of either sphere are going to begin to define their own priorities and capabilities relative to where they align and what they can possibly extract economically or resource-wise from either sphere. So in 2028, I think we're going to have a world that you have two largely self-sufficient spheres of influence, much as we had with the Soviet Union and NATO, NATO nations. But even then, this canard that there was no trade or no interaction economically between those two spheres was really silly. The Soviet Union famously, as the commodity brokers and things like that began to rise in the 70s and into the 80s, the Soviet Union famously utilized those guys as mechanisms of two-stepping Soviet energy products like oil and petrochemicals into the global market outside of the Soviet Union's sphere of influence. And in the same way, whenever they needed grain, they came calling to the U.S. and in a couple of cases like the Great Grain Robbery in 1972 actually managed to outfox us and secure enough grain supplies from the West that it put us into a real significant quandary of how do we deliver on these contracts and legally that we've made it on an international basis and still fulfill our own needs. So we're going to see more of that. In that way, it will be a somewhat similar feature to how the Cold War ran, where I do think the risk for China and Russia is that they're going to bite off more than they can chew too fast. They're going to certainly get out over their skis. And the U.S. still maintains, and the U.S. and I would say, by extension, Germany, U.K., France, we will see a pace of innovation continue to accelerate in spite of our best efforts to maybe make all the wrong decisions politically and economically. We are still just unbelievably productive capitalist powerhouses in many ways, despite the drawbacks of how we do things. We are still a place in the world where amazing cutting-edge research is being done, not only on electronics, but things like metamaterials, utilization of existing resources in more maybe efficient ways, or reuse of resources. So I think the world of 2028 is going to be defined by a couple of things, really. One, how serious does the Anglosphere plus Three Seas Initiatives kind of nations get about diving back into the production of things that matter. And I include shipbuilding in that, and because shipbuilding drives innovation in material science and steel production. You know, new builds of not just, you know, fancy fifth-gen fighter jets like the F-35, but also, you know, light attack aircraft and better commercial aircraft that work very effectively, but are maybe cheaper to produce because we've scaled down the cost of materials out of a need to utilize less material. You know, so many innovations come from, if not shortages, at least some pretty serious disruptions. And I do believe that we will, again, maybe in ways we don't understand now, but again, rise to that challenge and come up with newer and better materials and ways of making things that enable us to stay ahead of that curve. The other real challenge, I think, to the sort of emergent Russia-China sphere of influence is commie's going to commie. Right? Like that's probably the number one rule you can depend on, is that authoritarian systems, whether it's, you know, an autocratic regime, cult of personality situation like we've seen with Putin, or it is a full on, you know, communist system of control like we see in China, they tend to be, however big and powerful they get, at some point they become inherently self-limiting by the fact that they are first and foremost about power, and not about productivity, and not about lifting humans up at an individual level and giving them a reason to work and a reason to care. You can only rule by fear so long. And so that's where, when I say don't short America, but in the same breath, I talk about how dangerous things feel today. This is, you know, that's why. So 2028, we're going to look ahead and realize that things were as tough as they were for us now are going to be a lot better because we've continued to find ways to advance in spite of our own ways we hold ourselves back. I also think that we're going to see some real cracks in the armor very quickly of this new trade alliance and really geoeconomic, geopolitical alliance amongst the BRICS countries, because you're going to see these authoritarian regimes begin to operate in ways that are right now cooperative, but 2, 3, 4 years, when they begin to get stressed, when they run into challenges, our cooperation is going to crack and they're going to start to eat their own as well. So I do have hope. I do have hope, as difficult as things may look right now. I think that by just our own natural way of doing things historically, I think we're going to find that in ourselves again here in the West and get ourselves back on a little bit firmer ground going into 2030 and moving forward.
Do you, as part of that, Russ, do you see Europe, which has suddenly discovered the United States and other good trade relations to the east, to their west, do you see them continuing that trend? I mean, obviously when the Germans wake up and go, you know, maybe we shouldn't have done this, get dependent on Russia for gas and stuff. Is Europe going to come? Are we going to be back to a bit bigger, better NATO, EU, US, UK combination as a result of what's happened in Ukraine?
I think we will. And that how we respond, how NATO really responds to these challenges of today with Russia and Ukraine, I think is going to be very, very, very important to what happens economically for all the nations involved as well moving forward, not just from a security standpoint. NATO, you know, it began as a security compact, but it wasn't very long before the nations of NATO realized that because we're beholden to one another and cooperating in a security side, then we could cooperate economically as well. So I think economic ties and economic, you know, growth and dynamism grows from those strategic security relationships. From NATO's side, I think we've seen Germany and France in particular really exposed in some ways as vulnerable points in NATO. And I said as far back as 2019 that Poland in particular, but other countries as well, particularly former Comblock countries, largely, you know, your Visegrad nations and the Three Seas Initiatives, we're going to step up and take a bigger forward, even the ones that aren't part of NATO but are NATO adjacent, because of being in 3C's initiative with other NATO nations. You're going to see them, I think, step forward and in some ways replace or supplement and augment historically the role that kind of the big nations like UK and France and Germany have played economically and militarily in NATO. And I think you're going to see NATO become less of what it has been historically, and more about the dominance of the little guys playing a very important role in specific things. Estonia, particularly on the technology side, Estonia is an incredibly high technology, dynamic nation, not only economically and fairly well run, but also in terms of its technology output. Yeah, the Scandinavian countries the same way. And I think we're going to see a revitalization of some of the natural strengths of these countries being more appreciated and utilized as we take a look at what that changing face of NATO is in response to Russia and Ukraine. I'm all for Poland, you know, stepping forward and playing that bigger role. There is a significant economic engine there that I don't think has really been tapped into yet, despite the fact it's a pretty productive nation. And so I would like to see, from a policy side here in the U.S., us taking bilateral and multilateral approaches to really lifting up and supporting some of those countries, even if it maybe comes at the expense of a point of GDP for France and Germany, because we, you know, shifted something from one nation to another.
You know, one of the undertold stories, and we've touched on a little bit here, is and you can look at a map and almost miss the Black Sea, but when you overlay the sea lines of communications and the sheer value of the cargo that's shipped from the Black Sea through the Dardanelles into the Mediterranean to the rest of the world, it's an incredible choke point system. And, you know, we're talking about NATO, and one of the things I noticed that explains why John Conrad is not in the chat room. I don't think John's ever been in the chat room, but he's a, we all know John Conrad from G Captain, and he's been a guest here, and we interact on a regular basis. And he just sent out a tweet about when the show started that he's heading on Amtrak to go talk to the DOD's Maritime Administration and the Navy CNO, looking for questions to ask. And of course, one of the things that John's always been concerned about is, in case of war, that the Navy effectively has told our merchant ships that we're going to need to resupply across the ocean. They're on their own, which of course does not work. But what we saw in the Black Sea again was some NATO ships accidentally were hit for a variety of reasons by the Russians, but also everybody's old friend that they like to forget about at peace times, floating mines that had gotten loose from their moorings in theory during a storm. And it brought up the fact that it doesn't take that much of a ship or two, or the threat of floating mines and an inability, especially for the U.S. on its own, have to rely on other people more often than not to help with mine clearing, that the impact that can have on trade, because moving stuff at market prices, at the market price that people want it, nothing is more inexpensive to use as a way of convenience, large, bulky objects, than the sea and merchant ships. But there's insurance comes into play. And if a ship or two sinks, Lloyd's and the other shipping interests are going to make it uneconomical to be able to move things, if to even leave port. Have you seen any evidence that, besides John Conrad coming and screaming at the usual suspects, as he likes to do, and God bless him because somebody has to, that people are starting to get some traction on how fragile our economic system can be from something as simple as floating mines shutting down shipping like we've seen in the Black Sea? We're giving these little reminders now and then when they're small and medium problems before they become big problems. But have you seen anybody else that's joined the conversation that really has access to levers of power?
Yeah, it's that conversation is starting amongst an awful lot of ship owners who, you know, you talk about an industry that is phenomenally opaque and spectacularly corrupt in a lot of places, but is also so little known amongst the average person that kind of tries to watch these economic things. It's the ship owning industry. These vessels are tremendously expensive to build, maintain, operate, and we're seeing now that relatively small group of ship owners who depend on a relatively small number of banks, who depend on a relatively small number of clearing houses to settle transactions for the goods on the vessels, a relatively small regulatory body worldwide that helps maintain maintain the various rules and regulations that balance all these competing interests in shipping, the insurance companies, right? All of this is a relatively small pool of players and actors that have for a long time been both kind of at slow burn internal war with one another but also cooperate for mutual gain. And the decisions that these small bodies make have everything to do with how trade works in the world. So in talking with a few ship owners and talking with one of the largest privately held companies that charters vessels, they have an enormous fleet under various entity names and flags that they charter from ship owners on long-term basis. And I talked with their head of chartering. It's based in North America, and about grabbing a couple of vessels for some different customers that I work with. And I said, hypothetically, if I wanted to get a ship into the Black Sea to pull maybe some wheat out, I got someone that's willing to sell me wheat. They'll take the risk. You know, would any of your ship owners for your many dry bulk ships be willing to play? And they said, we wouldn't be able to insure it. We wouldn't be able to get the ship owner to agree to do it. We wouldn't be able to get a safe berth in any of the at any of the harbors or ports. They said, you're just not going to get a ship in. And I said, is that right? And they said, look, not only can we not get ships in, we've got ships already in the Black Sea that we're not able to move out, and they're just idling and waiting for hostilities to de-escalate or to be in some way be given safe passage. And they said, they did mention the threat of mines. Famously, towards the very beginning of the conflict in the Black Sea, you had a Cargill ship get hit by, no one's really sure quite what it was, but it was certainly a missile or a rocket of some kind. Punched a hole right in the side of the ship. It had to pull back into, I believe it was Odessa, and is now undergoing repairs on water while it's got a cargo full of grain. So these issues just keep piling up, and at some point, the level of risk, and I think we're there, has tipped over to the point that it's just going to be an all stop. Nobody is going to take that risk on of losing a $50 or $100 million asset with $50 or $100 million of product on it. So unless it is vessels that are owned by like nationally or state-backed enterprises, like Costco, for example, is a state-owned enterprise. Presumably Costco's risk could be underwritten if Lloyd's won't step up and do it. Then maybe the Chinese government would be willing to do that. I think you'll see some of these massively deep-pocketed national entities still take the risk, but for the most part, you're talking about an all-stop to trade there until they can get rid of the mines, until the risk of missiles or waterborne attacks goes away. There's just simply too many confounding factors there to make it, for the next several months at least, viable from a planning standpoint as a place to source or ship to.
Well, on that cheerful note, we've taken up an hour of your time, Russ. Before we let you go, though, I want to give you a chance to talk about anything you've got going on that you'd like our listeners to know about and that they can look forward to.
Yeah, I think really, really the big one, and I know there's, this is a sort of a naval-centric, show as well, but So God love everybody for listening to me ramble about food security and shipping issues for an hour. But one of the things that I really would love to see, and for anybody listening who maybe does have access to these levers of power, is in a position to whisper into some ears, I really would love to see a renewed multidisciplinary effort by Congress, by private sector stakeholders to grasp, to really begin, maybe for the first time, to quantify the risk that we have economically from maybe some of the decisions that we're making with programs in the Navy and commercial shipbuilding. I see that as probably the most underrepresented national security issue in Congress. God love Elaine Luria and some of the others for taking up that issue that have that background and that knowledge. But if I could pull a lever today and say what one thing would I do to begin to reinvigorate and also reinforce national security in the United States, it would be to make a really concerted effort to, within 20 years, have us being a shipbuilding power, commercial and naval, on par with the output that Japan and Korea and China have today.
Well, on that note, Ross, and I don't think we've mentioned it during the course of the show. If the listeners aren't already, you can follow Ross on Twitter @man_integrated. You can track him right there and just be overwhelmed with the wisdom. And for the listeners, speaking of Twitter, kind of funny, be careful when you mention John Conrad's name on Midrats, because he might be listening live. He just called me out. He just called me out on Twitter saying, "I'm listening." Well, John, we're damn glad that you're listening, and we're also damn glad that you're on Amtrak to go talk to some of those people that have access to levers of power. And regulars to Midrats should know who John Conrad is and G-Captain. He has really been one of the handful of people that has been strong and consistent and right on issues that slowly, it seems, Ross, more and more important people are starting to realize what time it is and some things that have been neglected that needs new attention. But it's been a pleasure having you on today, Ross. We'll continue to follow and interact with you, and we look forward to the next opportunity to talk to you.
God bless, gentlemen. I appreciate the opportunity and your time.
Well, thanks for being here with us today, Ross. It's been fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Have a good one, gentlemen.
You too. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. And until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy day. Cheers.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.